Let's talk. Talk. John Brown.
As I often say in these cases, I have been looking forward to doing this interview as soon as it landed on my desk up in the production studio. The book is called The Last Para. It is the final first-hand account of the Battle of Arnhem from former paratrooper John Humphreys and, of course, best-selling author Colonel Stuart Tootle. Delighted to say that the good Colonel joins us live on the line. Now, Stuart, good morning to you, sir.
Good morning, Josh.
For those who don't know your background, by the way, just to explain a little bit why you are particularly suited to bringing us this fascinating first-hand account.
Well, first of all, I developed a relationship with John Humphreys, as you said, this remarkable man who very sadly died at the beginning of this year in March. He was a former paratrooper. I'm a former paratrooper, obviously, of a very different generation. And what John did at Arnhem and what he did during the war generally, these guys set the standard, that generation, the Second World War of paratroopers. So, yes, the affinity between being a former soldier, my own experiences in places like Iraq and Afghanistan, not that I'm for a moment suggesting they stack up to what John's generation did in the Second World War, but there is that brotherhood of airborne soldiers, particularly in the British Parachute Regiment, which John was part of, although he was a Royal Engineer, but very much a paratrooper as well. So, yes, there's that close relationship. I have my own experiences. This is the fifth book I've written, generally with a veterans theme, starting with my first book, which was about my experiences in Afghanistan. So, yes, it's a combination of being a writer, a bit of an amateur historian, but most importantly, being a former soldier.
And this, one of the things is that Arnhem is hot-wired into the DNA of the Parachute Regiment in particular.
Yes, you're absolutely right. And during the research, and I spent 7 months last year on a weekly basis, sometimes several times a week, talking to John about his story, and then doing all the research around it to bring it alive, writing it in the first person. But when I was at Arnhem, and I've been there several times before, but I went particularly to look at John's journey to the bridge, because he was the last living veteran to actually get to the bridge. The majority of the 1st Airborne Division didn't actually get to that infamous bridge too far. But there's a cemetery just outside Arnhem called Oosterbeek Cemetery, and I looked at the Book of Remembrance, and there is an entry in that book written by a young paratrooper, a modern-day paratrooper, who had no doubt served in places like Iraq and Afghanistan. And he wrote of John's generation, "You set the standard." And although Arnhem in many ways was, well, it was a strategic battlefield disaster, but huge amounts of bravery, courage, sacrifice, fighting to annihilation. And by saying they set the standard, that's exactly what John did. And so Arnhem is a sort of iconic touchstone of faith to the British Parachute Regiment, because although it wasn't a disaster, it's the level of courage and sacrifice of small bands of determined paratroopers fighting against massive odds and holding out for days and days.
And when you look at, if you set it with the background to where it is, because a lot of people just think, quite rightly, because of the film Bridge Too Far, everybody's seen it, everybody went to see it, but they just think the bridge. But there is so much more. It is 3 days of people being dropped, and we'll get into the minutiae that in a minute. But if we set it in the context of where airborne operations were in the Second World War, you'd had the disaster with the gliders of Sicily, where 164 gliders head all towards city. It's a nightmare. Most of them ditch in the sea. Only a few make their objectives. And the raison d'etre of airborne operations are very much be put on the back burner. There were 17 council operations before Market Garden, and the big fear amongst the airborne troops, because they're a disparate bunch of adventurers to be an airborne soldier, as you yourself will probably admit to. It attracts a different type of person, much more initiative, fighting, you know, thinking on your feet. And the worst thing that they want is what's happened to, say, the German paratroopers, the Fallschirmjäger, who've gone from being paratroopers to being line infantry and finding themselves the Fallschirmjäger in Italy and firefighting in Normandy and all that sort of thing. So they are really geared up for Market Garden, because this is what they do, and they want the chance to prove it.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Now, and there's a dynamic. You mentioned Sicily, but also what was really important was what happened in Normandy 6 months before. So the 6th Airborne Division, which was the 2nd Airborne Division, John was part of the 1st Airborne Division, they had been dropped into Normandy, had an incredibly tough fight, holding off Rommel's panzers from pushing the Allies off the beaches, and played a vital role, but they were very successful. The operation was conceived to take all the paratroopers in, British dropping on one end of the beach, well, the beachheads, because obviously that was, you know, miles and miles of beaches in Normandy, and the Americans dropping on the other side. And they were going to basically hold the forces off to allow the Allies to get ashore the main seaborne landing. And although very costly, it was actually incredibly successful. But there were some real lessons of Normandy which were just not applied at Arnhem. So they jumped at night, where they had a better element of surprise. They also flew in within a 24-hour period. All their forces came in. So they had a level of force and capability on the ground, although very much fighting against the odds, because as you intimated, paratroopers are lightly armed forces. They don't have tanks. They don't have big supplies, limited amounts of ammunition. So the raison d'etre of airborne forces was to land, seize an objective, hold it, and quickly be relieved. Now, in Normandy, they were relieved relatively quickly, within 1 to 2 days. In Arnhem, and this was part of the problem, because the lessons of Normandy were ignored, and 1st Airborne Division, which went to Arnhem, was impatient to get into action. They had been held in reserves. You mentioned 17 operations planned, but cancelled for various reasons. And suddenly Arnhem was on, and they wanted to go. And the planners with Arnhem were also very complacent, because they thought, well, the war's going to end soon. You know, Germany is on the back foot. They're beginning to retreat, and we can jump in, seize these bridges, very light opposition, and we'll then link up with them. And of course, that didn't happen, because the Germans regained their strength. They resisted fiercely. The Allies decided to fly in the airborne troops, because remember, the Americans were dropping to bridges further to the south, but they did so over the 3 days you mentioned, and that lost the element of surprise, and the Germans had time to react. They went in during daylight. They lost that element of surprise. They dropped too far away from the bridges. Their supplies then came in over a period of several days, reinforcements, more ammunition. By then, the Germans knew what was going on, so they're able to shoot down a lot of those aircraft. And so Arnhem really is, to me, and very much to John, which is important, he said it was a battle of lost opportunities. It could have worked, but we ignored the lessons, whether it was Sicily or Normandy, and consequently Arnhem went very, very badly wrong.
And in the meantime, of course, you've got Second Army Group waiting on the border between France and Holland. And they don't set off, and they're supposed to punch their way up Hell's Highway all the way through. Eindhoven's been taken by the Americans, and they are going to push all the way up behind a rolling barrage, because some things from the First World War are still maintained. You've got, you've got Guards unit, I'm not sure if it's Irish Guards, in their tanks. 6 Shermans get taken out in the border straight off. And their thing is to literally go thundering up. And obviously, this is, for those who've seen the film, this is Michael Caine and Edward Fox, but yeah. You know, they're supposed to go punching up, but it's a damn sight more difficult when you've got a straight bit of road and you've got Germans on either side who are know you are coming. Same with the bridge at Eindhoven. And as you said, the main thing about parachute operations or anything like this is surprise. And they've lost that by day 3. And, you know, some of the descriptions of guys coming in on Dakotas on day 2, well, it's the flak is unbelievable. And there are units in because it's not like Normandy, where they're right behind you, and there are train links to Germany, and there are troops who've been mauled, German troops who've been mauled on Normandy, who are supposed to be heading east to sort of rest and recuperate, you know, further towards Berlin, but then get the order to go back and fight because they're coming down. You've got a Dutch SS there as well, and as you know, Colonel, it's a darn sight easier to defend than it is to attack. And you know, all the Paras have got 6-pounders, so there's not an awful lot you can do. And there's even a couple of sort of Luftwaffe flying around just to throw into the mix as well. So it's a tricky situation, to put it mildly. And also, everybody's running in little packets everywhere because it's the way that airborne operations are going at this point.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, one of the biggest problems about Arnhem was that they dropped them, not only sequentially rather than putting them down in one go, but they didn't jump around the objective, which was the bridge, basically, or the river crossings, because there was more than one, but the famous bridge. They dropped them 8 miles away. And John actually said, you know, we landed, no opposition initially. And as he described it, he said, and then we sat on our asses for about an hour before we got moving. And to move 7 miles, to move columns of men, and he was with the 2nd Battalion, the Parachute Regiment, which went down on one particular route and just managed to sneak past the Germans' very rapid reaction.
Because there are three, there's Lion, Tiger, and I can't remember, Leopard.
Leopard.
Yeah. And so it's not sort of the strong punch, is it? They've split the forces up.
And they had to work their way through crowds of jubilant Dutch people who initially thought, you know, the Germans were not going to resist. And then the German speed of reaction, which they were renowned for, was impressive. Literally, there was a training company of SS troops in the wood who went straight into the attack. So although they landed initially on opposed, then they were quickly opposed. Then more troops came in and blocked off the advance routes into Arnhem. 2nd Battalion managed to slip through, but then the trap closed behind them. And then the weight of the remnants of the 9th and 10th SS. So these were premier units that had learned their trade on the Russian front, proved themselves in Normandy. They had tanks, they were heavier forces, reacted incredibly quickly. And what I think is so remarkable, and when you read about John's stories, how long they held out for. Mm. I mean, John went into one particular building around the bridge and defended it for 4 days.
Yeah.
75 men, including himself and other paratroopers, went into that house. After 4 days of fighting, only 10 of them survived who hadn't been wounded or killed. They'd run out of ammunition. The house was being burnt around them by Tiger tanks, heavy tanks firing at point-blank range. But what was so remarkable about John's story is that when the commanding officer of his particular house said, well, you know, quite understandably, you know, lads, there aren't very many of us left. We've run out of ammunition. I think it's time to surrender. John actually said, bugger that, and made an attempt to escape by running into the remnants and the ruins of Arnhem, where he was eventually hunted down by the SS and caught.
This is the thing, because isn't it that they, because Arnhem's, is it south, the Arnhem is south of, the actual town is south of the bridge or north of the bridge? Because there's nothing, one point you've got, the bridge goes into Arnhem, but there's nothing actually, I'm not sure if it's the south end or the north end, and it's actually just marshland. And that, I think it's the south staffs who are told, don't go into the town, whatever you do, just get towards the bridge. But unfortunately, they get the orders wrong and some go into town, and then you have this literally, like you see in Stalingrad, you have this bitter house-to-house fighting. There's a tale about a German putting his head through a window and, you know, an Allied officer literally sticking his revolver in his head and doing him away like that. I mean, it is room to room, you know, floor to floor fighting. And again, those who have seen the film will know that Sean is it. And I'm based in Marbella, so we have a connection with Sean Connery. But he plays Urquhart. And of course, Urquhart can't help himself because he's a leading from the front guy. And he heads off into town and he gets stuck somewhere in Ustabik, isn't it? And he has to hide in a loft for 3 days.
Yeah, and you also had this massive problem with command and control. So, you know, their radios didn't work. I mean, you know, the few that did had very intermittent communications. So, and that had massive implications. Apart from this command and control, and Urquhart, the general commanding division, he got too far forward, he got lost, so commanders didn't know what was going on. So you had chaos and confusion, which didn't help matters at all. But what you also had on that was you couldn't bring in your air support, because you didn't have the radios to talk to the Typhoons, and air support would be massively powerful. It was working hard to get 30 Corps, which is that part of Second Army, punching up the Devil's Highway, as you described it. But 30 Corps were advancing on literally one road.
Yeah.
They couldn't go off, because to come back to the point you made, that the northern end of the bridge was where 2nd Battalion, Tupara holding out, was by the town end. And on the other side was Ponderland, so open marshland. Now, that's really where the para should have landed. But that same Ponderland, which was boggy, marshy, surrounded that one road. So you couldn't drive off the road when 30 Corps were trying to punch their way out to Arnhem.
Yeah.
So a relatively small number of well-dug in German troops could stop them. They'd have to clear the obstacle and then keep driving on this run road. So you had this combination of troops too far, lack of surprise, lack of radio communications, not able to bring in Allied air support, which, you know, John felt very keenly, because the Germans got their own aircraft. Yeah. bombing and strafing John in his positions.
How, I mean, the other thing you mentioned is because the troops go in thinking they're going to be resupplied. Logistics are what makes... logistics wins wars. You talk about Rommel, you know, Rommel loses North Africa because his line of supply gets cut off. These guys, after and it's in the film, it's a five-minute attack over the bridge that everybody knows about. It's the wrong tanks, by the way, in the movie. But, that's worth last. In reality, that battle lasts for 2 hours. Everybody is highly motivated, and they are letting off steam, to put it mildly. So they are shooting through their ammunition, and they suddenly realize that they're not getting resupplied. And so they can't, if they're being sniped, they can't counter snipe. And that means that it makes it almost impossible to hold a position. What's John's going through his mind as he realizes that they are running out of ammunition?
Well, John talks about that incident, the famous in the film where suddenly an SS reconnaissance battalion drives over the bridge and then all hell is let
sitting out of your tank halfway up just to make it easy. Yeah.
And John was part of that battle, and he remembers, as he says, shooting down from a building. And he had a Bren gun, which was a light machine gun. And he said, you know, he's just constantly changing magazines, shooting in. And he said it was like initially shooting fish in a barrel, because you had these German SS soldiers in their half tracks trying to jump out because their half track had been shot up and had crashed into, in one case, into the side of the building he was in. And he was shooting down at these people. And I said to him, how long did the battle last? And he said, I can't tell you. It could have been 10 minutes, could have been 2 hours. And it probably was about a 2 hour engagement. But he said afterwards, when the sort of dust settled and the shooting died down momentarily, he looked out of this window and he could just see the German dead around the house. And someone said to him, said, John, they're SS. What are they doing here? I thought they meant to be a bunch of schoolboys and old men holding this bridge. And it was this realization that suddenly they had elite troops and lots of them as an enemy to fight and limited ammunition. And I think John said, you know, on the fourth day when the building was burning around them, you know, he counted his rounds and he had three or four bullets left for a sort of submachine gun. And that was it, because they couldn't get the supplies in, because as 2nd Battalion was surrounded at the bridge and their perimeter was shrinking very valiantly. And this is why Arnhem as a whole battle is so important, is 1st Battalion, 2nd Battalion, the Parachute Regiments, the Staffords, 156, all the other para brigades were trying to fight to get to Arnhem in this bitter, bitter street by street, house by house, room by room fighting. And of course, it was slow and it was chaotic and it was causing huge numbers of casualties. And they failed. They didn't get there.
Mm.
Yeah, they ran out of steam, lost too many people.
And of course, it's not just because you mentioned that, you know, John was Royal Engineers. You have Remy as well. You know, Royal Electrical and Mechanical Engineers, who have a wonderful book called "With Spanners Descending," which is this is the best title for a book about that. You've got the Army Medical Corps. They've got the Army Medical Corps as well, who's trying to set up a field hospital. And the hospital itself, of course, gets taken and retaken. There's fighting around it. I mean, it really is. I'm not saying that it's like a video game, but it is one of those situations where it is the... We talk about the bocage in Normandy being close combat and nobody knows what's coming around. With this one, they have no idea what's coming around the corner, and it really is desperate fighting. But then again, these troops have the, you know, they're not normal line infantry, so they, you know, they're going to have a go. That's the ethos, and that, again, that goes back to why it's hotwired into the Paris DNA.
Yeah, I mean, everyone who fought in Arnhem, and it doesn't matter whether you're a paratrooper, a Royal Engineer, I mean, I say paratrooper, an infantry paratrooper, whether you're in the medical corps, the signals corps, whatever, they had all passed parachute, really rigorous, tough selection training. They had to volunteer it. Then they had to actually do the parachute jump course. And bearing in mind, parachuting was in its infancy. I mean, it was a dangerous thing to do. So by jumping from the air, they had become this particular breed of individual. But of course, what I think is also so important about Arnhem was the people they were fighting. You know, they were fighting the SS. You know, they were an elite German force, highly experienced, I said, with
fanatical. This, because again, they're fighting for the fatherland, and these are brainwashed. I mean, we would call, you know, they are fanatical, the SS.
Yeah, and I think what people also sometimes forget, and you just said it there, that in the latter part of the war, even though the Germans were quite clearly losing, they considered they were fighting for their homeland. You know, they were trying to keep the Allies away from Germany, so they were highly motivated and also exceptionally well commanded as well. You know, they had very tough, very experienced commanders. They took a lot of casualties, though, a lot of casualties. But what I think was also very interesting, and I didn't realise this until I sat down and helped John write his story, was the respect between the two sides. And the SS have an appalling, and rightly so, reputation for human rights abuses and war crimes. But generally, they treated, when they captured the British paratroopers, they treated them well. And there were truces during the battle so that wounded could be extracted. And you talked about hospitals changing hands, and each side looked after the other side's wounded incredibly well. So there was this high level of respect. And don't get me wrong, the battle was bloody and brutal and terrible. But there were these moments of how you might describe as a high regard for the laws of war and respect between the two forces, which the SS probably didn't show anywhere else during the Second World War, but they did in Arnhem.
Yeah, I was just going to say, because that's an interesting, I mean, it would never happen, you know, on the Eastern Front, and because that was just, I mean, both sides, they know that it's, you know, it's kill or be killed. And there's the commando order as well, which Hitler's put out. And as I said, it's the SS. But and Normandy, I mean, we see massacres by the SS in Normandy on the first day. Absolutely. You know, the Canadians and the Norfolks, I believe it is. But for some strange reason, there is that. I mean, let's not go too, it's not too chivalric, but it would be, there's a very famous photograph of the guy, the paratrooper giving the V sign. Yeah, yeah. And you think, well, that might not have happened because it, you know, in the heat of war, you don't know what your guys got, etc. But they took prisoners indeed. And presumably that's how John survives this.
Well, he did. I mean, he very nearly didn't survive. I mean, you know, the heat of battle frightened people, do sometimes appalling things. And when he was eventually captured, so he bolts into Arnhem, he escapes and evades, he's shot at several times, and he eventually goes to ground. He's unarmed by this stage, under a tramp, because he thinks it's the safest place. And then he hears an armoured vehicle, a tank basically, roll up to his position, and in very good English, a German voice says, "Tommy, if you don't come out, we're going to blow you out." And he hears the whir of this tank gun being down to where he is. So he thinks, the game's up. So he comes up with his hands out and his Marine beret on. And he's roughly handled by a couple of SS troopers. They sort of search him. One of them tries to take his Marine beret, which is the iconic status of a paratrooper, off his head. And John said, "Excuse my friend," but he says, "I'm shitting myself at this stage because I think I'm about to die." He's very aggressive, very young. He said they're probably 18, 19-year-olds. One goes to snatch his beret, and he knocks his hand away and says, "Don't touch that." And he suddenly realizes that the SS soldiers are as frightened as he is, probably more frightened of them. The Roten Teufel, the Red Devils that they'd been fighting, the great name and reputation the Germans gave the British paras. And then he's forced down on his knees and he feels this Luger pistol in his back and he thinks he's going to be shot. Mm. It's the German officer in the tank who actually intervenes and stops them and says, "Do not shoot him."
But is the tank of an SS or is that Wehrmacht? Because
no, it's SS.
It's as well, SS. Okay.
Yeah, it's 10th SS Division.
Right.
It was actually a Stug III assault gun,
The self-propelled. It's still enough to it would sting a bit if it shot at you, put it that way.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, yeah. Especially if you're an unarmed para with just a para.
Exactly. How was John's memory of this? Because, I mean, again, it can be very difficult sometimes because, things, you see a film and you think, oh, that's kind of what happened. Or your memory plays interesting tricks sometimes, but presumably he was, as sharp as the proverbial.
Yes, I mean, he was. I mean, John was 102, so 101 for most of the writing of the book. Failing eyesight, as you'd expect, of a gentleman of that age, quite hard of hearing. So, I had to learn to speak incredibly loudly when I was talking to John. His memory, he had remember incidents in sort of technicolor detail. being captured, shooting at the SS. Sometimes his memory of the wider battle of what other formations were doing was much less clear, and that's when I come in as the author to do the research.
But you don't. But you don't see that as a soldier. You don't know the giant. All you know is what's, you know, it's what you can only fight what's in front of you. You don't know what's happening, you know, on the perimeters. You just know what's happening to you and your mates. That's
yeah. And no, and it's a very good point. And you know, I've written other books about officers who do have a generally broader view of what, the bigger picture of what's going on.
Yeah.
But just like John, they would turn around and say, yeah, but I was interested in my tank, my troop, the hedgerow in front of me, the distance from my trench to where the enemy was. I didn't really know what else was going on because I was too busy focusing on the here and now. So you're absolutely right. And John was very good at the here and now, you know, this detail about being captured, you know, how he felt, jumping over walls, machine gun bullets chasing him as the SS were after him, you know, and you know, he even said at one stage, you know, he dropped into a flower bed having been shot at, and he was desperate to have a pee. He can remember it, you know, and he suddenly said his focus became on opening his fly and relieving
fire. Yeah.
What is, you know, and he can, you know, remember things like he had one meal in 4 days. He talked about they used Benzedrine, which was the sort of stimulant to keep them alive, and the difference that meant. So, you know, he remembers seeing different images coming out, and he said, well, you know, I was pretty doped up for some of this. So this remarkable level of how they found water, which was in very short supply, you know, how they held out, how the rooms burnt around them. And he remembers, I mean, his description of a Tiger tank firing an 88 millimeter shell repeatedly crashing through the rooms that they were in. And, you know, he described it as like an express train coming through the side of the wall as these high velocity rounds came in. So, and you could really see, I mean, John was a real warrior. And, you know, his story isn't just on him. He'd been in North Africa for 18 months. He'd been a prisoner of war in Italy. He'd escaped 3 times and then eventually got away. He'd been wounded in Tobruk. He had a mention in dispatches from Tobruk. So, you know, these, he had this amazing span of 5 years of war, but these technicolor details, and I always remember one of the most almost amusing things was when John was wounded in Tobruk. So this is, you know, 2 years before Lana.
42.
He's wounded by a Morse shell. He's knocked unconscious. He wakes up, face covered in blood. And he can remember these two Africa Corps soldiers standing over him with their Schmeisser machine pistols. Literally, you could make this up. It's like a cliche. And one of them said, "For you, Tommy, the war is over." You know, and just that sort of rings out of this. Gosh, you know, we men of my age sort of grew up with our grandfathers all fighting in the war, and battle and action and air fix.
Yes, commando comic, exactly. Warlord for you, Tommy. The war is over. I could talk to you obviously until about next week about this, but I'm going to run out of time. The book is called The Last Para. It's by John Humphreys with Colonel Stuart Tootle. If people want to find you online, where's the best place to find you?
Best place is probably to look on Amazon. That's where the book is. You know, I'm on LinkedIn.
And you can order the book off our own virtual bookstore. The book is called The Last Power. You can order it via our virtual bookstore. It is the 80th anniversary of Arnhem. And did you think it was worth it, is my final question for you there, Colonel. Did John think
John absolutely did. And don't get me wrong, I'm no apologist for Arnhem, and it was a disaster for all the reasons we talked about, Charles. But I would ask John this question. I would say, you know, was it worth it? And he said it was. But he said, but you've also got to stand. And this goes back to your first point about the status of being a paratrooper. He said, but at the end of the day, we were paratroopers. We had a job to do. We were at the point of the spear. That's what we signed up to do. And that's the way the modern day parachute regiment would see it. So it doesn't matter. It was a disaster. When the nation calls and there's a difficult thing to do, the parachute regiment goes.
Thank you so much for your time today.